I want to begin today with a story. The source is the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center. The article is Lookout Mountain, Missionary Ridge, and Protecting the Flag, from an event November 24th and 25th of 1863. I'll begin here with this quote. After being defeated at Chickamauga, Georgia, in September of 1863, the Union retreated back to Chattanooga, Tennessee, a railroad town that each side wanted to hold. The Confederates held the high ground around it. The Union strengthened their numbers, and Major General Ulysses S. Grant planned an attack. On November 24th, Union troops, led by Major General Joseph Hooker, took Lookout Mountain from Confederates under Major General Carter Stevenson. The next day was the battle for the neighboring Missionary Ridge. Union Major General William T. Sherman's initial attack was unsuccessful, but Major General George H. Thomas, who had stood firm while others fled at Chickamauga, earning him the nickname Rock of Chickamauga, brought his soldiers, who took the ridge. In a letter home a few days after the battles, Cheney described for his wife the awful grandeur of the scene. At Missionary Ridge, as well as some heroics, he observed from his battery's position, quote, the color, this is a subquote, the color bearer nears the top. He's writing to his wife what they observed. The color bearer nears the top. Will he live to plant that flag on that fort? Or must he fail and another do it? It must, will be done, are our thoughts. God grant he may. He leaps upon the parapet, and the tattered and torn but honored flag waves in triumph over their fort. Continuing, the article says, behold, or beyond the practical use of making a unit's position on a battlefield or of marking a position's, let me start that again because that came out completely wrong. Beyond the practical use of marking a unit's position on a battlefield, flags were symbols of a unit's pride in themselves and their country. As such, they were never to touch the ground. Soldiers often stitched the names of battles on their unit flags, making the flag a history of a unit's actions. The stars on the American flag represented each state in the Union. During the Civil War, it retained the 39 stars as a symbol that the Union would be made whole again. Cheney wrote to his wife on July 27th of 1863 that he felt the United States would, quote, come out of the war without the loss of a single star. It was an honor for a soldier chosen to carry either the unit's flag or the American flag into battle, but dangerous. Enemy units would try to capture the flags or take down the bearers. Defense of their flags was a high priority, and fellow soldiers were quick to take up a flag if the color bearer fell. The act of planting the American flag on Missionary Ridge, former Confederate territory, symbolized reclaiming the land. You're wondering, where are we going to go with a story that starts like that? Well, here we see an example, a military example, and this would always be the framework of this context. What does it mean to plant your flag? If you're going to plant your flag, we use that today in the modern vernacular, you know, towards how we defend ground, so to speak, that we want to defend. We plant a flag on ground that we think is important. To plant your flag means to mark the hill or plot of land upon which you are willing to die fighting. The ground upon which the flag is planted is the battlefield upon which we choose to make our stand to defend at all cost. Of course, in the context of our spiritual journey, we're not talking about a physical battle, you know, which we put our lives on the lines for some piece of ground. The battles I'm talking about here are the conflicts that we have with other people. As we look at the world today through the lens of end-time prophecy, it's easy to focus on conflicts between nations, conflicts between ideologies or political parties. But I'm not talking about those kinds of conflicts. Jesus Christ gives us a warning, and I want to be clear that this warning that he gives to us, I'm not saying that this applies today. I don't know that it does. I'm not using it in that context, but it's an important warning we should take note of regardless. I'm turning over here to Matthew chapter 24. In verse 3, we'll begin in verse 3, and I'll read through 10, Matthew 24, verse 3, continuing through verse 10. Now, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" So now we have the context that Christ is going to address, the end of the age. And Jesus answered and said to them, "Take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise up against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in various places." Pretty easy to kind of look in the news today, right, and see a lot of this stuff happening. It's getting told and showed to us every day. It seems more and more of this. The war in Ukraine with Russia certainly stands out among the conflicts in the world. But we're hearing of food shortages. We're hearing of supply chain disruptions. My wife reports when she goes shopping. Still, I'm going to go shopping. When she goes shopping and she tells me how it looks when she shops, she's saying that the store shelves don't look like they used to. And probably those of you who shop, man or woman, just saying I'm not the one that shops in our house, are going to find that same situation. So we see what he's talking about here to some degree, right? Pestilences, COVID, anyone? All these, verse 8, all these are the beginning of sorrows. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. Who's that? Who's he talking about there? He's not talking about the world. He's talking about the church. I'm not saying that we're here. There certainly is interpersonal conflict in the church. It happens because we're human beings. We're going to have interpersonal conflict. But it is something I think that should stand out to us as a warning that Jesus Christ is saying that in the church, this will be a part of what it looks like in the end time. And I don't think any of us wants to look in the mirror and say, "Hey, when Christ returns, do you want him pointing his finger at you and saying, 'Yeah, let's talk about you'?" Right? So none of us want to live there. And I think in that context is where I'm coming from this message. That maybe we should be looking at ways in which we can mitigate interpersonal conflicts with one another and in the world that we live in as a practice, so that maybe before Christ returns, we're not going to be one of those that he points to and says, "Yeah, that was you I was talking about." And I think we'd all like to be thinking that we are working towards not doing that, working towards unity and love in the church. So I began with this story, this war story, of picking a hill, planting a flag, and being willing to die there, because this tends to be what happens in interpersonal conflicts. If we want to reduce interpersonal conflicts in our lives, if we want to avoid having those, we need to ask ourselves a very important question in areas of interpersonal conflict, especially when things begin to escalate. The question is this: is this the hill I'm willing to die on? I think all of us would find our relationships would improve if we would stop planting flags and dying on hills with other people. Today, I want to explore how asking ourselves this question can help us avoid interpersonal conflicts and strengthen our relationships with other people. Specifically, I want to explore how personalities, opinions, and beliefs can cause interpersonal conflict if we allow it, and see how asking this question can help. Is this the hill I'm willing to die on? These three areas that I want to talk about today are just three areas. This is not an exhaustive review of all the areas of interpersonal conflict between human beings. But I think if we walk through these three, this will give us a good enough foundation that we can begin to look at other areas where we might say, "Hey, you know what? I experienced some conflict, but not over one of those three things. It was over another area." And maybe then I should ask myself a question. Is this a hill I'm willing to die on? We all know, I'm going to begin with personalities. We all know that personalities differ from person to person. Some people are more assertive. Some are not. This isn't a choice between good and bad personalities. People have different traits. Some people are adventurous. Other people are more risk-averse. Some people are more social, and some are more introverted. Some people are loud. Guilty. Some not so loud. My wife. She's a good balance for me, right? Some people are born leaders, and some people prefer to follow a good leader. There's lots of areas within personalities for potential interpersonal conflict. I think to myself immediately about two leaders who both want to lead the same group. That can lead to conflict. Two well-known figures in the New Testament would have to be the Apostle Paul and Barnabas. Their early work and travels together in bringing the gospel to the Gentiles, well documented. But at the end of Acts chapter 15, we have something recorded, a conflict between them. So I'm going to go to Acts chapter 15. And reading here, beginning in verse 36. Then after some days, Paul, here we are in Acts chapter 15, verse 36. Then after some days, Paul said to Barnabas, "Let us now go back and visit our brethren in every city where we have preached the word of the Lord and see how they are doing." So this would be his second missionary journey. Now Barnabas was determined to take with them John called Mark. But Paul insisted that they should not take with them the one who had departed from them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to the work. Then the contention between Paul and Barnabas became so sharp that they parted from one another. And so Barnabas took Mark and sailed to Cyprus, but Paul chose Silas and departed, being commended by the brethren to the grace of God, and he went through Syria to Cilicia, strengthening the churches. Contention. This is a disagreement. To become sharp is, you know, sort of gives you the imagery here, I guess, of just how bad it got between them, two people entrenched on a position, to the place where they could not go together. Now, it's interesting that you note that there is a difference in personalities between the two people. How did Luke describe Barnabas? Earlier in Acts chapter 4, Acts chapter 4. I am a train wreck up here, knocking things over. Acts chapter 4, verse 36 and verse 37. And Joseph, who was also named Barnabas by the apostles, which is translated son of encouragement, a Levite of the country of Cyprus, having land, sold it and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. Son of encouragement. So this is a character trait. This is a personality trait of his. He was an encourager. So you have this encourager on the one part. You have an episode in which John Mark leaves on the first missionary journey. He decides he needs to go back to Jerusalem. So he leaves and departs Paul while Paul was still working. As Paul said, he left the work. Barnabas was ready to forgive him and let's bring him along. Young man, we're trying to encourage him, we're trying to teach him, and trying to forgive him and love him. And what was Paul's attitude? No. Well, why? Why was Paul so staunch about that? Well, Paul describes himself a certain way. His personality is one of being extremely driven and passionate. He tells the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians chapter 11 something about himself. From Paul's perspective, he repeatedly sacrificed for the work. There was no higher calling to him. So in Paul's mind, John Mark turning back to go back to Jerusalem, that's just the stuff of, you know, wimps, if you will. Why didn't you, what's the saying, you know, like pull yourself up or you know, get a stiff backbone here. We've got work to do. It doesn't have to be easy. In fact, Paul says to the Corinthians just how much he endured because he was mission-driven and very passionate about it. 2 Corinthians 11, verse 23, he begins here. I'm going to pick this up because there's a lot above this where Paul is simply saying he's using the word fool. He's talking about boasting about himself, and he uses that in the context of the world's foolishness in boasting about themselves. But that's not really relevant to this point. Verse 23, I want to pick it up here to see what he says about what he has endured. Are they ministers of Christ? He begins. He's talking now about Judaizers in some form that had come into this congregation and had been trying to move them away from the truth. So he says, are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more, in labors more abundant, in stripes above measure, in prisons more frequently, in deaths often. From the Jews, 5 times I received 40 stripes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 I was stoned. 3 I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I have been in the deep. In journeys often, in perils of waters, in perils of robbers, in perils of my own countrymen, in perils of the Gentiles, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren, in weariness and toil, in sleeplessness often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness, besides the other things, what comes from me daily, my deep concern for all the churches. There's no better description for somebody who's deeply mission-driven, who's passionate about their work. All of the things that Paul endured. Paul didn't have any time for somebody that was going to turn their back, pull their hand from the plow, who wasn't ready to be fully committed to this and do all the work that Paul was willing to do. On the other hand, Barnabas was ready to forgive right away. Let's welcome him back. Let's show him some mercy and some love. So we had a conflict. How was it resolved? They separated. At the end of the day, one of the things that we have to be aware of is that this is what can happen from interpersonal conflicts. They can become so sharp that we might lose friendships over something that may be really stupid. You think Paul later would look back on this episode and regret it? It seems he certainly did find forgiveness with Mark. He referred to him, asked him to be brought to him, to comfort him. If you see what he said, I asked myself the question, did he reconcile with Barnabas? These are two Christians in God's church. Did they reconcile? Well, the answer is yes, because if you read over in Corinthians, 1 Corinthians, you're going to see that he refers to Barnabas. As he says that, is it only me and Barnabas that don't get to... that have to work a job in order to pay for the ministry? Is it just so he's referring to Barnabas in the positive? So they clearly must have reconciled at some point. We've probably all met someone who had a personality that we just didn't care for. And I think sometimes that's because we really don't know them. And if we took the time to get to know them, our feelings might change. Oftentimes, that's all it really boils down to, is I really don't know who the other person is. In other words, I haven't walked a mile in their shoes. And maybe if I would, our relationship would change. Some people just can't be gotten along with. I like how Proverbs illustrates this point. Proverbs chapter 21 and verse 9. There are going to be people we're going to meet that probably we're just not going to get along with. We're still going to have to find a way to get along. And maybe that means we just don't talk. Because Proverbs 21:9 says, better to dwell in a corner of a housetop than in a house shared with a contentious woman. Now, not all women are contentious, and that's clearly not what I'm saying. But it is illustrative to the mind, right? Like, if we know somebody that's just difficult to get along with, you can't say anything that makes them happy. You'd really rather just... not be around them. That's all. This is just an acknowledgement that this is real. I don't know that I know of anybody who's a contentious woman. I don't think I do. But I can imagine if you're married to one that's just always arguing with you, that you probably would get frustrated. And so it is an illustration that personalities can be different, and sometimes there's nothing you can do about it. But the best advice I think the Bible gives on this is from 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7. 1 Peter 3, 7. I understand you'll get the context here. It's pointed in one direction. Husbands, likewise, dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife. That's who he's talking about here, as to the weaker vessels. The key here is not that it's the wife. This is in terms of interpersonal relationship. The key is dwell with them with understanding. How do we gain understanding? Well, that takes work. You have to invest yourself in the relationship, don't you? To understand who they are, where they're coming from, what their troubles have been. You have to walk a mile in their shoes. And that's probably the best advice that we can have, because while we may not dwell with a particular individual we may have potential conflicts with, somebody that we maybe don't get along with because our personalities just don't mesh very well, we can apply these because we may have to engage with them, converse with them, or work with them. And to the extent possible, we need to do so with understanding so that we can avoid having a personal conflict with them. And these are things that we can practice. And like I said, it takes work. We have to put in effort to get to know them, to learn what they're really like from their side of things. You know, one of the most popular tropes in movies and books, it's called the enemies to friends storyline. You're familiar with this? The enemies to friends storyline. Younger people might relate to this if I bring up an example. I'm dating myself with this now because this is so old now. Toy Story. Right? Emily, did you watch Toy Story? Yeah, you had to. I'm sure Connor loved it. All right. Toy Story is a great example. Woody and Buzz Lightyear. Right? Did they begin as friends? How many here have watched that movie? Come on, raise your hands. It's everybody. This is a great reference then. Nailed it. This is perfect. Everybody's familiar with this story. Most everybody. If you're not, I'd encourage you to go watch it. It's a cartoon story. This was before Disney went crazy. So, Woody and Buzz Lightyear, they're toys. I'll just remind us all, they're toys. And when the kids aren't around, the toys become animated. And Woody's the favored toy. Until Buzz Lightyear shows up. New, fancy, lots of lights and sounds coming out of him, and he's battling Zurg out in outer space. This is his great enemy. He still thinks he's actually a ranger, a space ranger. And so, but Buzz is ignorant of the relationships that exist. He sees himself as a space ranger, and Woody sees him as competition. And Woody's jealous of him. Why? Because he's the new favorite toy. So he's jealous, and they can't stand each other. They're always now competing against each other. Well, I don't think Buzz actually realized he was competing for a long time. Well, Woody was definitely competing. He wanted to be the leader. I'm the leader. And so that's basically the story. But what happens at the end? They both learn about each other. They finally come together. They become best friends. And then we have Toy Story 2, 3, 4, whatever we're on now, where they're just out there saving the world together. They're best of friends. Well, that's a very common thing. Because how common is it that we don't know somebody, we don't know what they're going through, we have no idea the troubles that they've been experiencing, and maybe the first time we meet them, that might be a low point for them. And I might not like what I see. And I might not want to be friends with this person the way that I see them, but I don't have any idea what they're like or what they're going through. If we're going to avoid interpersonal conflict, we need to make sure we put forth the effort to learn about them then and build that relationship. I want to encourage us to not let differences in personalities cause us to have interpersonal conflicts. Whether that's in the church or not makes no difference. There simply isn't a hill there worth dying on. What about, this one's really sensitive, opinions. How many of us have opinions about anything? Like all of us have opinions. You can't help it. What is an opinion? Well, the simplest way to understand an opinion is that it's a temporary subjective view. Meaning, subjective means that it's subject to my own personality, what I like, what I don't like, my experiences, and so forth. So it's subjective. It's not objective. They're subjective almost all the time. We form them long before we have facts. Okay? So I may not know anything about the current new Ford F-150, but I might instantly like it because, in my opinion, Ford's the best truck. I don't know anything about this. They might just be the worst truck out there. I would have no idea. Until I actually start looking into the facts, and then maybe I discover that there might be, it's not possible, but there might be another truck out there that I might like better. So maybe there is. It's probably not. My point is, opinions are subjective. Each of us has our own. How many of us have changed an opinion in the same day? Started with this opinion, and by the end of the day, my opinion had changed. Probably all of us, because they are very temporary by nature. Okay. How many of us lead in conversation with our opinion about something? It's like one of the most dangerous things we can do from a perspective of interpersonal conflicts is to lead with your opinion about something. If you have an opinion on one side, almost assuredly, someone has a different opinion about that. And people can be fanatical about their opinions. I was at a golf tournament with Mr. Wilson and Mr. Reeves here. Just to show you how crazy opinions are and the decisions that can be made based off of your lousy opinion. In this particular case, a young lady at the golf tournament was manning a table where she was displaying her wares to all the architects that were coming through. I'm not an architect, Mr. Reeves not an architect, but Mr. Wilson is, so we were supporting his foursome by playing golf with him. And we get to this hole. This lady, she's representing an insurance firm. And she's lovely. She's young, clearly. She opens up the cooler and says, it's a hot day. So would you like some Powerade? Yes, thank you. What colors do you have? I don't know why we order our Powerades by colors. Is it the weirdest thing? Like instead of saying, no, I want this flavor, you don't identify the flavor. Like you would say, I want a Coke as a flavor, 7-Up as a flavor. This Powerade, you go by color. And so I reached in there. I'm looking for red because red is fruit punch. That's my favorite one. There's nothing better. I've tried them all. There's nothing better. I reach in there. I grab a red one. I said, this looks really refreshing. She goes, yeah, but that's not as good as the yellow one. Clearly delusional. Are you kidding me? It's like she's not even tried the red one. You can't come to that conclusion. So I took the card and I went home, and then later the next day I emailed her boss and said, look, I'd like to do business with you, but clearly something's wrong with your organization. You have somebody like that on board. So I was teasing him. But you know what I'm saying? We all have opinions about things. And even if you're deadly wrong, you still have an opinion. And we all have them. But it's when we shove that opinion down someone else's throat that we begin to bring the risk of an interpersonal conflict in. You ever notice the difference between how somebody comes to you and says, hey, I'd like to know what you think about this, versus someone who comes to you and says, I'm going to tell you what I think about this. Do you see the difference? Maybe I don't care what you think about this, especially after you tell me what you think about it. One of the things that I would say that I loathe the most about social media is it's a platform for sharing opinions. Everyone's got one, and so everyone's free to share it. And where better to share your opinion with the whole world than on Facebook or Instagram? I don't know. I'm not up on all the platforms, okay? But they're out there. Twitter. They call it Twitter trolling, right? So I think this is one of the great evils of our time, because people are now oversharing all of their dumb opinions, things that cause offense to other people. But you've got this wonderful platform to do it, and people can be very cruel with their opinions. I think I read to you years ago when I was a message I was giving, and I was looking at the effects of social media, and one of the big negatives is what it has done to middle school girls who, at the front end, when Facebook was first really taking off, I mean, you had MySpace first, but who really, that was people in their 70s used MySpace. You know, Facebook was for the new people in 2010, 11, and 12. But yet, classmates, especially in middle school, girls were brutal with one another. And one of the problems is the social shaming that would go on these platforms. And it crushed a generation. Still ongoing to some degree amongst that age set, because they're what? Vulnerable. to opinions. 13, 14-year-old girls vulnerable to opinions, really? Of other people, really? Of their friends, really? I raised one, two. Yes. They are very vulnerable to that, and so they can have their feelings hurt, and people are just too free to share their stupid opinions. You know, and over the years, I've joined several different, quote, groups, thinking, how many of you have been invited to join a, I'm going to say Facebook again, and I know I'm dating myself, joined a Facebook group because it professed to be a group in which we were going to talk about spiritual things, biblical topics. So this is what the reason for this particular group would be, for us to raise biblical questions and then have biblical dialogue. I've joined several of those, and I've left every single one of them. Because almost always, they turn into, this is my opinion. Not what the Bible clearly says that is not what you agree, that does not agree with your opinion. Your opinion is in conflict with what the Scripture says, but you don't care. I do. So I would join them thinking and having the highest hopes and expectations, and I've always left because I'm always disappointed that they turn into an opinion fest as opposed to a Bible fest. Opinions can be a great source of interpersonal conflict. And we have to be thinking about whether or not we are prepared to, you know, be asked a question or whether we're leading with our opinion. Something Paul said to the church at Rome might play well for us in terms of this context in Romans chapter 14. Can we be guilty of this even in the church? Yeah, to some degree we can. Romans chapter 14, verse 1 says that, I'll read this in the New Kings first. It says, receive one who is weak in the faith, but not to disputes over doubtful things. Not to disputes over doubtful things. So, there's a better rendering of this. I like the way the English Standard Version translates this. It says, as for one who is weak in the faith, welcome him, but not to quarrel over opinions. You know, one of the challenges that any person has, and almost at any point in our journey, in our spiritual walk, we can have challenges with applying biblical principles, can't we? If the Bible doesn't say, thou shalt do this or thou shalt not do that, then we have to apply principles in order to make decisions about what we shall or shall not do then. That's sort of what the walk's all about, learning how to apply biblical principles in our lives, right? What if we have a young person? This is scripture Paul here is talking about. What if you have somebody who's newly converted? Paul dealt with a lot of newly converted people. And you're dealing with somebody who's newly converted, who's trying to figure out what things mean and how to apply the scriptures in their life to live the best version of Christianity that they can. Well, what if they don't perfectly understand how to apply something in a particular area? You know, Paul dealt with the eating meats offered to idols in the temples, but then being offered in the marketplace. Some who are weak in the faith had one opinion. Others in the church had another opinion. He said, stop doing that to each other. Each of us has to do this on our own. We have to walk this walk on our own. If somebody comes to us and says, I'm really struggling with this, and you have the maturity and the experience, naturally you should share and help them to understand. They're coming to you. They're asking. Then that's what we're supposed to do. Are we supposed to go to them and say, I see you're having this problem, and let me tell you what you need to do about it? That's a recipe for success. Let me give you my opinion. Didn't we just live through some of this over the last 3 years? I mean, if I mention the word COVID, and then in the same context, I mention vaccines, wearing masks, social distancing, shaking hands. There's all kinds of things, all kinds of areas within that where people had opinions. You shall not get vaccinated because it's wrong. You shall not tell me I'm wrong if I get vaccinated. Wearing masks doesn't work. Don't tell me that I am supposed to wear a mask, or you should wear a mask because it's good for all of us. Lots of debates. How many people got their feelings hurt because their opinion wasn't respected? How many people shoved their opinions down somebody else's throat without invitation and caused a hurt? Doesn't matter if you're in the church or not on that one, does it? Because it was all over the place. Everybody had an opinion. And people were very quick to share their opinion. And some people out there don't like your opinion. They don't have a problem on social media shaming you over your opinions. And I know some people have told me that they were shamed over decisions that they made. It happens. The opportunity for us to cause offense and have an interpersonal conflict in the area of opinion is ripe. That is fertile ground. And every single one of us really does need to take a look at how do I handle sharing my opinions about things. If I want to have peaceful relationships, am I leading with my opinion? Am I shoving it down somebody else's throat? Or am I waiting? Am I sharing it when I'm asked to share it? Interpersonal conflicts are far more likely to happen when we plant our flag on a subject that is simply a matter of opinion. The damaged relationships that can happen are simply not worth it. When it comes to opinions, there just isn't a hill there worth dying on. What about beliefs? The difference between beliefs and opinions is beliefs are durable, subjective views. They're the stuff that we spend some time with, we have a direct experience with, we've studied into some things, and we make that a part of our system that we develop our values based off of. And we can be very defensive about our beliefs. Naturally, when we are confronted, when we're challenged on those beliefs, we can become very defensive. Or we can create a defensive reaction in someone else when we challenge their beliefs without permission. Let me read something here from the Council of Europe, an article titled Religion and Belief. Religions are related social and cultural structures. Religions and related social and cultural structures have played an important part in human history. As mental structures, they influence the way we perceive the world around us and the values we accept or reject. As social structures, they provide a supporting network and a sense of belonging. In many cases, religions have become the basis of power structures and have become intertwined with it. Most people take their religious beliefs very seriously and do not like to be challenged on them. You know, we have a gospel message that we try to preach to this world, but we're not in your face about it. If you watch what our outreach is, you don't see us in people's faces. We're not denigrating their beliefs. We're trying to point them to the truth. And we're trying to do that with love and compassion. That's the work that God has put before us, and I think we do a pretty good job of that. Are other churches that way? Are other beliefs that way? I stumbled across an article from BBC that was quite disturbing to me because of the innocent nature on one side and the vehemence on the other. The article was about an Indian man in India who was a tailor. He inadvertently posted a favorable comment on social media in support of a political figure in India who had made a denigrating comment about the Prophet Muhammad. And if you know anything about Islam and the Muslim religion, you do not denigrate the Prophet Muhammad. There are those who are not going to allow that to stand. This man was persecuted for days and days and days, finally closed his shop. When he reopened it, two Muslim men came in on the pretense of getting sized for a new suit or some piece of article of clothing, and they killed him in the way they killed them, which I don't want to be graphic here, but they killed him in his shop. They videoed it and then they posted it on social media claiming they had done it, and they told us why. He had denigrated, by supporting this comment, the Prophet Muhammad. And he had to pay with his life as a lesson for everyone else. Do you think the moment that he posted that, he was thinking, I just put my life on the line? Probably not. In that area, the Hindus and the Muslims are constantly against each other, and the attacks one to the other can be brutal. I was thinking about the posting portion of that. It's a self-inflicted wound, and I'm sorry, that's a terrible way to say that, but in the sense of he created his own problem. If you know in your country that this is a a very contentious issue between two different religions. Why would you poke the bear? Well, that's the extreme. But can we wound somebody else by being insensitive to what they believe? Yes. Have we? Probably. I don't know if I'd say all of us. I'm not trying to paint us all with the same brush, but something I think we should think about. I've learned over the years when it comes to our church that none of us has a perfect understanding of the Bible. There are definitely things in the Bible that are, especially as you get out away from the trunk of the tree, where we can have interpersonal conflicts even in the church because somebody has a different belief than I do. And they may hold that belief pretty tight. And they may not be movable on that. Mr. Slocum's sermon, that's a great illustration of what can happen with people and their beliefs. We truly can become very entrenched, intractable upon our beliefs. And so are we then open to somebody coming to us and saying, hey, I want to change your beliefs? I will tell you that I'm not open to somebody convincing me that the Sabbath is on Sunday or that it's any day of the week you choose to honor God. I'm not open to that. So we're probably not open to some of this, are we? But are we assuming that everybody else is? Their minds are open? That's fertile ground? Let's just go ahead and challenge all of their beliefs? If you want a good fight, that's how you start it. People hold some of these beliefs extremely passionately. And I think we need to be sensitive about that and be careful about how we approach that and how we lead with our own opinions. We all share in this church, we all share a certain fundamental set of beliefs. I would imagine that every single one of us probably reads through the United Church of God's fundamental beliefs and says, yes, 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 right down the line. But the further away from the trunk of the tree we get, the more into the branches that we get where people still anchor themselves on something that you look at them and you might say, I don't agree with you. I don't think I can support that conclusion that you're drawing way out there. Look, the farther out somebody gets, the more twigs that they're standing on, the more possibilities exist for interpersonal conflict if we allow it to happen that way. Are we okay with that? Are we okay that they might have something that's out way out on a twig here that they believe and they hold passionately without challenging them all the time, confronting them over it, maybe shaming them over it? I hope we don't do that. Or do we have to plant our flag right in the middle of that? Is that a hill we should die on? A really helpful principle in Proverbs, I think it would be useful here. Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 19. Proverbs chapter 10. And verse 19. I'm going to read this to you from the NIV, so if it reads a little differently, I just like the way that it reads better. Sin is not ended by multiplying words, but the prudent hold their tongues. This is a solution we ought to be living by pretty regularly, right? If it's not going to help the situation, does it have to be said? If it can hurt the other person, does it have to be said? Right? Because it says, this reminds me of the old statement, if you ever find yourself in a hole, the first thing you do is stop digging. If you want to get out, stop digging. And that's the kind of what this is talking about. You're only hurting yourself here. So stop. You're making it worse. James makes the point somewhat more plain over here in James chapter 1 and verse 26. James chapter 1 and verse 26, it says, if anyone among you thinks he is religious and does not bridle his tongue, but deceives his own heart, this one's religion is useless. Again, let me reread that for you in the NIV version because I just think it sounds better. It's easier to process in my mind. The NIV says, those who consider themselves religious and yet do not keep a tight rein on their tongues deceive themselves, and their religion is worthless. He goes on in chapter 3, to rebuke the tongue, teaching us that we really need to mind what we say. I'll read verses James chapter 3, 1 through 10. My brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment. For we all stumble in many things. If anyone does not stumble in word, he is a perfect man. He's saying, look, we are going to stumble in relationships. We're going to say the wrong thing. If somebody hasn't done that in their life, they are perfect. That's what he said. They're a perfect human being. Which means, because there are no perfect human beings, we've all done this. He says, he's a perfect man, able also to bridle the whole body. Indeed, we put bits in horses' mouth that they may obey us, and we turn their whole body. Look also at ships. Although they're so large and are driven by fierce winds, they are turned by a very small rudder wherever the pilot desires. Even so, the tongue is a little member and boasts great things. See how great a forest a little fire kindles. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature, and it is set on fire by hell. Verse 7. For every kind of beast and bird, of reptile and creatures of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind, but no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poison. With it we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the similitude of God. Out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not be so. When a person comes to us and wants to hear what we think about a matter, then they will ask us, right? If they want to know, they're going to ask us, well, what do you think about this? What did Peter say? 1 Peter 3:15? Memory verse for me. 1 Peter 3:15. But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts and always be ready to what? To give your opinion before anyone asks. To tell them what you believe long before they care. It says, be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you. With meekness and fear. The attitude with which we are to respond is even included here. When you're asked, provide a defense. The defense there is the concept here in terms of defense is to provide an argument for. It is to say, I believe this that you're asking me about, and this is why I believe it. And you can provide a defense for what you believe, and you can do a fairly good job of that. And it says you should be ready with that kind of defense you've already studied and know. That's what you're supposed to do. Okay. But then we're supposed to give that defense. When we are asked, we're supposed to then give that defense with meekness and love. Meekness and fear, excuse me, is what it says here. Meekness and fear. Our attitude. Humility and a fear of God in what we say, because as he said, when you're answering, you are the teacher of your belief. God's going to hold us accountable for that, so we want to be careful about that. When we lead with our answers to questions that have not been asked of us, are we planting our flag on that issue? Are we inviting others to fight with us on a hill that neither of us is going to walk away with unscathed? As we wrap up this message, I want to read another story to you to help illustrate the point that I've been trying to make. This is from History.com, an article titled, This Day in History, Bloody 10-Day Battle at Hamburger Hill Begins. Hamburger Hill was the scene of an intense and controversial battle during the Vietnam War. Known to military planners as Hill 937, which is a reference to its height in meters, the solitary peak is located in the dense jungles of Vachau, which is a valley of Vietnam, about a mile from the border with Laos. I don't know how to say that precisely. Laos, I think. Though the hill, which is called apt be a mountain, had no real tactical significance, taking the hill was part of Operation Apache Snow, a U.S. military sweep of the Yashau Valley. The purpose of the operation was to cut off North Vietnamese infiltration from Laos and enemy threats to the cities of Hue and Da Nang. Under the leadership of General Melvin Zeiss, commanding general of the 101st Airborne Division, paratroopers engaged a North Vietnamese regiment on the slopes of At Bia Mountain on the 10th of May, 1969. Entrenched in well-prepared fighting positions, the North Vietnamese 29th Regiment repulsed the initial American assault, and after suffering a high number of casualties, U.S. forces fell back. The soldiers of the North Vietnamese 29th Regiment, battle-hardened veterans of the Tet Offensive, beat back another attempt by the 3rd Battalion, 187th Infantry, on May 14th. An intense battle raged for the next 10 days as the mountain came under heavy airstrikes, artillery barrages, and 10 infantry assaults, some conducted in heavy tropical rainstorms that reduced visibility to near zero. On May 20th, General Zeiss sent in two additional U.S. airborne battalions, plus a South Vietnamese battalion, as reinforcements for his increasingly disgruntled soldiers. Finally, in the 11th attack, the North Vietnamese stronghold was captured on May 20th, when thousands of U.S. troops and South Vietnamese soldiers fought their way to the summit. In the face of the 4-battalion attack, the North Vietnamese retreated to sanctuary areas in Laos. On June 5th, just days after the hard-won victory, At Bia Mountain was abandoned by U.S. forces because it had no real strategic value. The North Vietnamese reoccupied Hamburger Hill a month later. Why am I sharing that story? Hopefully we can see a connection here. When we plant a flag on a hill, are we ready to die on that hill? This is the question. Is this a hill I'm ready to die on? Is the question. The fact of the matter is, we do not have to participate in every fight we're invited to join. And we don't have to start fights either. We don't have to be the cause of interpersonal conflict, whether that's in the church or in any other relationships that we have. Because this is the carnage. This is just a real-world extreme example of the carnage. 630 Vietnamese were killed. 72 Americans died, 372 wounded, all for a hill nobody wanted. To me, that's a real interesting analogy for our Christian walk in this area. How often have we chosen to die on a hill that we didn't have to, but we did it anyways, and we hurt others and ourselves in the process? As we reflect back on those senseless battles, are we happy with our decision to fight that fight? Because I'm pretty sure we've all done it. Brethren, if we want to have better relationships and avoid having interpersonal conflict, we need to carefully consider where we plant our flags and which battles we choose to fight. Is there a hill we may have to die on? Yes. There is a hill out there somewhere we may have to die on. But I don't think any of us have seen that hill yet. Have a happy Sabbath.